Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Michael Roy with highlights from our February 2010 issue. Featured in the journal this month, Confronting Catatonia. In this month's clinical case conference, we'll present the case of a young woman with catatonia who was treated with ECT, including some of the complications and consent issues that faced the treatment team. Managing medical care. We'll report the results of a clinical trial that examined an intervention designed to improve provision of primary medical care for patients in community mental health settings. Long-acting olanzapine. We'll report the results of a clinical trial that compared several doses of long-acting injectable olanzapine for maintenance treatment of patients with schizophrenia who had already been stabilized on an oral regimen of the medication. Course of cognitive deficits. A 30-year prospective study of a New Zealand birth cohort was able to create a timeline of cognitive deficits during the childhood and early adolescence of subjects who later developed schizophrenia, in order to examine whether these problems were static or dynamic and add to what is known about the neurodevelopmental model. Suicide in the heart era. A long-term study compared the suicide rates of people with HIV in the years before and after the introduction of highly active antiretroviral therapy. The rates went down, but not for everyone. And finally, suicide in the genes. A genetic study found a relationship between suicidal events and two polymorphisms of a gene affecting the HPA axis in adolescents being treated for depression. But we begin with the clinical case conference by Mark Zisselman and Richard Jaffe about ECT in the treatment of a patient with catatonia. A 19-year-old woman was first hospitalized for manic excitement that was followed by mutism, immobility, and refusal of food and fluids. Fever, elevated CPK, and autonomic dysfunction led to consideration of a malignant catatonic syndrome. Rigidity, posturing, and waxy flexibility were also present, and no organic cause could be identified. Treatments with amantadine, bromocriptine, and lorazepam were unsuccessful, and so electroconvulsive therapy was deemed appropriate. Because the patient couldn't provide consent, guardianship was required. At the guardianship hearing, it was determined that the patient's 22-year-old sister was the family member best able to serve as a temporary emergency guardian. Informed consent for ECT was obtained from the guardian, and the first treatment was administered 2 days later. The initial ECT session produced a seizure. However, this was followed by torsades, a form of ventricular tachycardia. Immediate cardioversion was required. It appeared that muscle damage due to the catatonic immobility had led to acute hyperkalemia with the administration of succinylcholine for muscle relaxation during ECT. At this time, multiple conversations were held with the sister, addressing the potential risks and benefits of continuing the ECT treatment course. The treatment team was unable to delineate any additional treatment options for the malignant catatonia, which, left untreated, is associated with high morbidity and mortality. There had been a glimmer of initial response to ECT, but there was now an associated risk of reintroducing the life-threatening arrhythmia with future treatment. Ultimately, the guardian chose to continue the ECT, viewing it as the best hope to get my sister back. The patient responded to 8 subsequent ECT sessions, which were administered with rocuronium, a non-depolarizing muscle relaxant. By the conclusion of these treatments, the patient was eating and drinking adequately to meet her dietary requirements, engaging in daily physical therapy, and communicating appropriately with the treatment team, her family, and her friends. Eventually, the patient was adequately stabilized medically and psychiatrically for discharge to a rehabilitation hospital, where she remained for 21 days. At a 3-month follow-up appointment, the patient reported that she was living with her boyfriend, that her ambulation was almost back to normal, and that she had resumed her usual activities. Now, catatonia occurs in approximately 5% of hospitalized patients. Almost half suffer from an underlying mood disorder. Malignant catatonia is characterized by the acute onset of excitement, delirium, fever, autonomic instability, and cataplexy. It's considered a medical emergency, and until the advent of ECT, most patients with malignant catatonia died. The term neuroleptic malignant syndrome has been applied when the condition is associated with antipsychotic drugs. It affects up to 1% of patients treated with antipsychotics, usually within the first 2 weeks of exposure. The differential diagnosis of catatonia includes a number of neuropsychiatric illnesses with catatonic signs. Catatonia has been reported in response to antihistamine overdose and withdrawal from levodopa, amantadine, benzodiazepines, clozapine, and anticonvulsants. When catatonia is correctly identified, it can be rapidly and effectively treated. Critically ill patients urgently require treatment to reverse hypothermia, maintain stable blood pressure and cardiac rhythm, ensure adequate oxygenation, and avoid renal failure. Discontinuation of antipsychotic medications is generally recommended, especially in cases of malignant catatonia or neuroleptic malignant syndrome. However, while all antipsychotics can induce neuroleptic malignant syndrome, a number of case reports indicate that atypical antipsychotics can be effective in treating catatonia. Despite the absence of controlled studies, benzodiazepine treatment has become the standard of care for non-malignant catatonia. This usually responds to parenteral lorazepam at 6 to 20 milligrams a day. Case series and open trials suggest that ECT is highly effective for all forms of catatonia. Some investigators believe that ECT should be initiated by the fifth day after inadequate response to lorazepam. In malignant catatonia, further delay is associated with greater mortality. Informed consent for ECT is a distinct process. This case was further complicated by the need for guardianship, which requires legal adjudication. Authorization to consent to ECT is generally not included in medical guardianship and must be specifically petitioned of the court. Therefore, it's essential for the treatment team to be familiar with local laws to assist families in pursuing guardianship. In addition, ECT usually consists of a series of treatments, during which there may be changes in the patient's mental status or the risk-benefit balance. The cardiovascular effects of ECT generally resolve without adverse consequences. A variety of dysrhythmias may occur, however. The patient in this case had required pretreatment with metoprolol for tachycardia, presumably because of sympathetic overactivity, as is often seen in catatonia. The seriousness of her dysrhythmia and the need for cardioversion after ECT required a vigorous re-examination of the procedure to reduce the risk in subsequent treatments. Succinylcholine is generally considered the drug of choice for muscle relaxation in ECT. However, it can cause potentially dangerous elevations in serum potassium levels in a variety of neuromuscular conditions. In situations of potential hyperkalemia, it's generally recommended that a non-depolarizing muscle relaxant, such as rocuronium, be used instead. While catatonic withdrawal is rarely identified as a possible setting for direct muscle damage, immobilization has been recognized as a risk factor for hyperkalemia. Therefore, it may have been indirectly responsible for the episode of torsades that occurred during the first ECT session for this patient. The fact that she had normal cardiovascular responses with a non-depolarizing agent in subsequent sessions suggests that hyperkalemia may have occurred. Cardiovascular care, as well as general medical care, were the targets of a randomized trial of medical care management for community mental health settings, which is reported in this issue by Benjamin Druss and colleagues. An important factor in the excess morbidity and mortality seen in persons with severe mental disorders appears to be poor quality of medical care. Provider, patient, and system factors, acting individually and in conjunction, are likely to contribute to these deficits in care. In general medical settings, there's increasing interest in using care managers to help improve the quality of care and to coordinate care across multiple systems. Rather than provide direct medical care, these staff provide education, advocacy, and logistical support to patients. This type of system was tested in PCARE, the Primary Care Access, Referral, and Evaluation study, in a community mental health center. Patients were recruited through flyers, contact in the waiting room, and referrals. More than 400 patients were randomly assigned to the medical care management intervention or to usual care. In the intervention condition, two registered nurses followed a manualized protocol. To help each patient overcome his or her own barriers to primary medical care, the care manager gave the patient information about each medical condition, available medical providers, and upcoming appointments. Motivational interviewing techniques were used to help support the patient's self-management skills. To overcome provider barriers, the care manager served as an advocate for the patient and as a communication conduit to specialty providers. The care manager maintained a provider list, and with the patient's permission, providers were notified about changes in the patient's medications and medical status. Coaching was provided to patients to help them interact more effectively with providers. If needed, the care manager also accompanied patients on provider visits. To address system-level barriers to care, the care manager worked to help enroll uninsured patients in entitlement programs. Public transportation tokens were provided as needed, and other factors that could keep patients from attending appointments, such as child care, were also addressed. The patients who were assigned to usual care were given a list with contact information for local primary care clinics that accepted uninsured and Medicaid patients. At baseline and the one-year follow-up, the quality of primary care was assessed according to 25 indicators. Most of these related to aspects of the physical examination, screening tests, vaccinations, and education regarding lifestyle choices. The average proportion of patients receiving indicated services at 1 year was 59% in the intervention group, but only 22% in the usual care group. the difference in change between the two groups was statistically significant. The presence of a primary care provider was determined on the basis of the patient's own report and documentation of primary care visits. At the follow-up assessment, patients in the intervention group were significantly more likely to report one or more visits to a general medical doctor. Also, previously undiagnosed medical conditions were identified in 12% of the intervention group, but only 2% of the usual care group. The most common newly diagnosed conditions were hyperlipidemia and hypertension. Among individuals with cardiovascular conditions or diabetes, there is also an assessment of quality indicators for the care of diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and coronary artery disease. Within this subgroup, patients who received the medical care management intervention had a significantly greater increase in the proportion of these services received than the subjects in the usual care group. Health-related quality of life was assessed by using the 36-item short-form health survey. At follow-up, the score on the physical component had improved 2% in the intervention group and declined 3% in the usual care group, but the difference wasn't statistically significant. However, there was a significant difference in the change for the mental component of health-related quality of life, an 8% improvement in the intervention group versus a 1% decline in the usual care group. Care management also has the advantage of being fairly inexpensive and practical for even relatively small sites. Existing mental health care managers can be retrained to add medical services to their scope of activities. Our next report is about treatment with long-acting injectable olanzapine, which was compared with the oral formulation in a 24-week randomized double-blind trial of maintenance treatment in patients with schizophrenia. John Kane and colleagues introduced the study by noting that depot antipsychotics can improve adherence, which might reduce the risk of relapse. Long-acting injectable olanzapine is a new formulation. To assess whether it's suitable as a maintenance treatment for schizophrenia, a relapse prevention study was conducted. Stable patients were switched directly to long-acting injectable olanzapine from their oral olanzapine regimen, and their rates of relapse were compared with those for patients who remained on the oral formulation. In addition, 2-week and 4-week injection intervals were compared, as well as 4 different doses. The low dose was 150 milligrams injected every 2 weeks. This was comparable to approximately 10 milligrams per day of oral olanzapine. The medium dose of injected olanzapine was 405 milligrams given every 4 weeks. This was comparable to approximately 15 milligrams per day of oral olanzapine. The high dose contained 300 milligrams and was given every 2 weeks. This was comparable to approximately 20 milligrams per day of oral olanzapine. In lieu of placebo, a very low reference dose of the injected drug was also tested. It contained 45 milligrams and was given every 4 weeks, comparable to approximately 1.5 milligrams per day of oral olanzapine. Patients with a diagnosis of schizophrenia were gradually switched from the previous antipsychotic to open-label oral olanzapine monotherapy. If they remained stable for 4 consecutive weeks, they entered the current trial. More than 1,000 patients were randomly assigned, and about 300 were assigned to the oral formulation of olanzapine at a dose of 10, 15, or 20 milligrams a day. The primary efficacy measures were the rate of psychotic exacerbation and the length of time before exacerbation. Over the 24-week treatment period, 84 to 95% of the patients taking therapeutic doses of either oral or injected olanzapine were free of exacerbations. For the group taking the very low reference dose of long-acting injectable olanzapine, the rate was 69%, which was significantly lower than the rates for the groups receiving standard doses. The rate of exacerbation did not differ significantly between the combined groups on 2-week regimens and the group on the therapeutic 4-week regimen. Also, neither of these rates differed significantly from the overall rate for the oral formulation. All comparisons met criteria for non-inferiority. The length of time before exacerbation was longer for all 3 standard doses of long-acting injected olanzapine than for the reference group. In addition, the time to exacerbation was shorter for the low-dose injection group than for the high-dose injection group and the oral olanzapine group. Symptoms were assessed with the positive and negative syndrome scale. The groups receiving standard doses of the long-acting injection and the oral treatment group all maintained mean total scores in the mid-50s, which indicates sufficient symptom control throughout the study. However, the very low-dose reference group showed statistically significant worsening over time, with mean total scores increasing into the mid-60s. 2 patients receiving long-acting injectable olanzapine experienced events that were attributed to possible inadvertent intravascular injection. Both of these patients had symptoms of dizziness and malaise within 10 to 20 minutes of injection. These were followed by gradual worsening and symptoms of excessive sedation or delirium that were consistent with olanzapine overdose. No changes in vital signs were noted. The 2 patients were hospitalized and fully recovered approximately 60 hours after injection. During the open-label treatment with oral olanzapine preceding the trial, mean body weight increased by 1 kilogram. During the trial, weight increased further with the therapeutic doses of both long-acting and oral olanzapine, for a total mean increase of 2 to 3 kilograms. Weight gain was greater for the group receiving high-dose long-acting olanzapine than for the low-dose group. The high-dose group also showed a mean increase in prolactin, whereas the other groups showed a decrease. The high-dose group also had a higher incidence of shifting from normal to high triglyceride levels relative to the groups receiving the medium, low, or very low reference dose of injected olanzapine. However, the rate of triglyceride abnormality did not differ significantly from the rate for the oral treatment group. Schizophrenia was also the subject of the 30-year prospective study by Abraham Reichenberg and colleagues on static and dynamic cognitive deficits in childhood preceding adult schizophrenia. Although premorbid cognitive deficits in schizophrenia are now well documented, there are still three fundamental questions. The first one concerns the developmental course of cognitive functions before the onset of illness. The developmental deterioration hypothesis predicts premorbid decline in cognitive performance. The developmental deficit hypothesis predicts static impairment manifested as deficits that emerge early and remain stable. The developmental lag hypothesis predicts growth in cognitive abilities that lags behind the more rapid growth of healthy individuals. The second question is whether different cognitive functions follow the same course. The third question is whether neurodevelopmental deficits are specific to schizophrenia or are common to other psychiatric disorders. This study was based on the Dunedin Multidisciplinary Health and Development Study, a longitudinal investigation of the health and behavior of a complete cohort of children born between 1972 and 1973 in Dunedin, New Zealand. They've been tested numerous times, beginning at age 3 and most recently at age 32, when nearly 1,000 members of the cohort were available. The Wechsler Intelligence Scale for Children Revised was administered to the cohort members within 1 month of their birthdays, at age 7, 9, 11, and 13 years. 8 subtests were included and covered 3 major cognitive domains: verbal comprehension, perceptual organization, and freedom from distractibility. The raw scores for each subtest were transformed to mental age scores. These represent the chronological age for which a given level of performance is normative and can be used to monitor a child's individual development over time. By age 32, a total of 35 cohort members met the criteria for schizophrenia. The study also included individuals with recurrent episodes of depression to provide a comparison group with a similar chronic course and severity of illness. A third group comprised healthy subjects with no mental illness, including substance use disorders. The childhood tests of the schizophrenia group did not provide evidence of cognitive deterioration. Developmental increases in cognitive functions between ages 7 and 13 were seen in these individuals, as well as the healthy subjects and those with depression. The schizophrenia group showed early and static cognitive deficits on 4 tests: information, similarities, vocabulary, and picture completion. These impairments emerged by age 7 and remained steady throughout puberty. Calculated in terms of mental age, the extent of impairment on these tests ranged from 0.4 to 0.8 years. Developmental deficits were also apparent, but less striking, among the subjects who had recurrent depression as adults. Compared to the healthy subjects, these individuals had lower values for vocabulary and block design. The schizophrenia group also had some developmental lags. They had slower growth than the healthy subjects on the block design, arithmetic, and digit symbol tests, which measure freedom from distractibility and visual spatial problem solving. Developmental lags were less apparent in the depression group. They showed slower growth only on arithmetic. An important question is whether the early deficits and the later developmental lags occur in the same individuals. To address this, Reichenberg and colleagues examined correlations among the 35 subjects with schizophrenia to see whether lower values at age 7 on the tests showing cognitive deficits predicted slower change in the tests showing developmental lag. The correlation coefficients were strong and positive, suggesting that the children with early verbal deficits also had developmental lags in processing speed and working memory. The findings from this study make 3 contributions to the neurodevelopmental model of schizophrenia. First, they point to both deficits and lags in cognitive development in children who will go on to develop schizophrenia as adults. Second, different cognitive functions appear to follow different developmental courses from childhood to early adolescence. The developmental deficit model appears to apply to verbal and visual knowledge acquisition, reasoning, and conceptualization. The developmental lag model appears to apply to freedom from distractibility and visual spatial problem solving. Third, these patterns are not shared by recurrent depression. Now we'll turn to the first of our articles on suicide. Olivia Kaiser and colleagues studied Suicide in HIV-Infected Individuals and the General Population in Switzerland, 1988 to 2008. They compared the suicide rates before and after the introduction of highly active antiretroviral therapy, referred to as HART. All patients enrolled in the Swiss HIV cohort study were included in the analysis. This is about 40% of all HIV-positive patients in Switzerland, and 70% of all patients with an AIDS diagnosis. A survey was conducted to gather more detailed information on psychiatric conditions and treatments in patients who died by suicide. For comparison with the general population, data from the Swiss National Cohort were also used. The Swiss National Cohort is a longitudinal study of mortality based on the linkage of individual anonymous data from census surveys to routine mortality files of the Federal Office of Statistics. Crude suicide rates were calculated by calendar year and by the pre- and post-heart periods. The pre-heart period was defined as 1988 to 1995, and the post-heart period was 1996 to 2008. To examine the separate effects of time period and changes in immune status, the authors performed an analysis that included the difference between the baseline count and each subsequent count. The analyses were also adjusted for several baseline variables: age, sex, injection drug use versus other route of infection, CDC clinical stage A, B, or C, and psychiatric treatment in the 6 months before enrollment. Standardized mortality ratios were obtained by comparing suicide rates in the Swiss HIV cohort study with rates in the Swiss national cohort. For each year, the expected number of suicides was calculated by using national rates specific to five-year age groups and each sex. More than 15,000 HIV-infected patients were included in the analysis. Of these, 150 died by suicide over the entire study period. From the years before HART to the period following its introduction, the suicide rate in HIV-infected men per 100,000 person years declined from approximately 450 to 90. In women, it fell from 150 to 63 per 100,000 person years. The ratio of the suicide rate in HIV-infected men to the rate for men in the general population fell from about 14 in the pre-HART era to 3.5 over the last several years of the post-HART period. For women, this standardized mortality ratio fell from more than 11 to approximately 6 in the later HART years. The decline in suicide rates was associated with an increase in CD4 cell count. In both HIV-infected patients and the general population, the risk of suicide was higher in older individuals and in men. In the HIV-infected patients, infection through injection drug use, CDC stage C, and psychiatric treatment at baseline were additional risk factors for suicide. The relationships with gender and clinical stage were stronger in the pre-HART era. More than 60% of the HIV-infected patients who died of suicide had a diagnosis of mental illness. Typically, it was made after the diagnosis of HIV infection, and depression was the most common diagnosis. A significant minority of patients had not been treated for these mental conditions, but psychiatric treatment was more likely in the post-HART era. Suicidal behavior during the treatment of depression in adolescents was the focus of the study by David Brent and colleagues, who report an association of FKBP5 polymorphisms with suicidal events in the treatment of resistant depression in adolescent study, also known as TORDIA. There's concern about the small but significant increase in spontaneously reported suicidal events in adolescents treated with SSRI antidepressants. This has led to a growing reluctance by clinicians and families to use antidepressants. In this context, it's important to personalize treatment by identifying which patients are most likely to respond to antidepressants and least likely to experience a suicidal event. Pharmacogenetics holds promise in this search because it examines the relationship between genetic variation and clinical response to a given medication. Brent and colleagues analyzed the relationship of both treatment response and suicidal events to polymorphisms in serotonergic and other neurotransmitter systems, as well as those involved in the HPA axis. The participants in the study were more than 300 depressed adolescents who had not responded to an adequate trial with an SSRI. Nearly 60% entered the study with clinically significant suicidal ideation, and nearly a quarter had a previous suicide attempt. They were randomly assigned to one of four treatments: a different SSRI, venlafaxine, a different SSRI plus cognitive behavioral therapy, or venlafaxine plus cognitive behavioral therapy. Suicidal events during the study were classified according to the Columbia classification algorithm of suicide assessment. A suicidal event was defined as a new onset or worsening of suicidal ideation or behavior. A suicide attempt was defined as self-injurious behavior with explicit or implied intent to die. The patients were also genotyped for 15 candidate genes or polymorphisms that have been reported to be related to depression suicidal events, treatment response, or venlafaxine's mechanism of action. By the end of 12 weeks of treatment, the groups who were switched to medication plus CBT had higher response rates than those who were switched to a medication alone. There was no difference in response rate between the two medication groups, and there were no differential treatment effects on the occurrence of suicidal events. 18 individuals had at least one suicidal event during the trial. 4 made suicide attempts, 2 communicated suicidal intent, 4 had new onset suicidal ideation, and 8 had worsening of their suicidal thoughts. There were no univariate relationships between genotype and treatment response, and no gene-by-medication interactions. However, there was a significant association between suicidal events and 2 polymorphisms of the FKBP5 gene. Each of these polymorphisms had a homozygous genotype that was present in half of the patients with suicidal events. These associations did not differ across treatment groups and were statistically significant even when restricted to patients who didn't respond to treatment. Also, genotype was unrelated to previous attempts, self-injury, or baseline suicidal ideation. There was evidence of a recessive effect, insofar as it was homozygous genotypes that were associated with increased risk of suicidal events. Although participants who were homozygous for these alleles made up less than 10% of the sample, they accounted for nearly 40% of the suicidal events and conveyed a 9-fold increase in hazard of suicidal events. The FKBP5 gene codes for a protein that decreases the sensitivity of the glucocorticoid receptor to the effect of the corticosteroids. The 2 allelic forms identified in this study have previously been associated with the development of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, a higher number of depressive episodes, a more rapid response to antidepressants in adults, and a higher risk for bipolar disorder. Healthy human adults, who are homozygous for each of these alleles, show a greater and more prolonged cortisol response and higher levels of self-reported anxiety during a test of social stress compared with individuals who have other genotypes. In vitro, exposure of cells to glucocorticoids induces an increase in FKBP5 messenger RNA, with the 2 identified genotypes being the highest expressing variants. These 2 genotypes have also been shown to induce the greatest reduction in the sensitivity of the glucocorticoid receptor. The association between suicidal events and a genotype linked to subsensitivity of the glucocorticoid receptor and excessive cortisol response is consistent with findings that have linked suicidal behavior with insensitivity of the HPA axis to feedback and increased cortisol secretion. This concludes the audio highlights of the February 2010 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the full text of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments regarding this audio. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Next month on our audio program, Susan Schultz returns to highlight mirtazapine augmentation in antidepressant treatment, the prognosis of bipolar depression with substance disorder, psychiatric outcomes of traumatic injury, and the effects of modafinil on sleep in chronic cocaine users. We hope that you'll join us again. Thank you.